the guard station. He cut the man a sharp stare, then added, "For the sake of your own hide, you better hope he is still alive." The ox grunted and begrudgingly strolled down the gangplank behind them. Marched along the dock, Summer tried in vain to spot Dirk in the water. Further pleased, the guard went unheeded. Walking beneath an overhead lamp, she saw a coldness in his eyes that gave her pause. While perhaps not a sadist like the ship's watch, he appeared more than capable of pulling the trigger on an uncooperative captive. A blow of disheartenment seemed to strike Summer, and she plodded forward with her head low, awash in helplessness. She suspected that Dirk had probably been unconscious when he hit the water. Several minutes had since elapsed, and she now choked on the bitter reality. He was gone, and there was nothing she could do about it. Johnson reached the base of the gangplank and peered into the water. There was no sign of Dirk's body. The burly thug examined the edge of the dock but found no watermarks indicating that he had pulled himself ashore. There was no way he could have swum the length of the ship without being seen. Somewhere under the surface, he knew, the man lay dead. The watch stared off the gangplank at the flat waters a last time, then ambled back onto the ship, cursing the shore guard. 10 feet under the surface, Dirk was unconscious, but far from dead. After the fall, he had fought to regain his senses, but he was hopelessly ensnarled in the blackness. For brief moments, he was able to break through the veil and seize vague notions of feeling. He sensed his body moving through the water without effort. Then something was wedged between his lips, followed by the sensation of a flowing garden hose jammed into his mouth. Soon the curtain returned, and he again drifted away into a calm darkness. A pounding at his temple brought him back a second time. He felt a rap against his back and legs, then he felt like he was being stuffed into a closet. He heard a voice say his name, but the rest of the words were indecipherable. The voice vanished with the sound of receding footsteps. He tried with all his might to pry open an eyelid, but they were cemented shut. The pain in his head returned, growing fierce until a constellation of stars burst before his closed eyes. And then the lights and the sound and the pain blissfully departed once more. Chapter 21 Summer was led off the dock and past the long building housing the pumping station. The unexpected brutality against her brother had been a shock, but now she willed herself to suppress the difficult emotions and think logically. What was so important at the facility that would warrant such behavior? Were they in fact pumping CO2 onto the tanker? She glanced over her shoulder at the guard, who marched several paces behind with his pistol drawn. Even the hired guards acted like it was a top-secret installation. The drone of the pump machinery receded as they walked past the main building and across a small open area. Approaching the administration office and adjacent security station, Summer heard a rustling in some bushes to her left. Recalling the stuffed grizzly bear in the cafe, she quickly stepped right to veer away from the noise. The confused guard swung his gun hand after Summer while cocking his head toward the bushes. The rustling ceased as the guard stepped closer, then suddenly a figure rose from behind the bushes, swinging his arm. The guard spun his gun to fire, but an object whipped out from the prowler's hand and struck him on the side of the face before he could shoot. Summer turned to see a dive belt, its lead weights strung to the end, clank to the ground. The guard had also dropped hard, but managed to stagger to one knee. Stunned and bleeding, he slowly re-aimed the pistol at the shadowy figure and squeezed the trigger. Had the toe of Summer's foot not struck the guard's jaw, the bullet might have found its mark. But a hammering kick to his mouth forced the shot high and laid the man out. He slumped over unconscious, the gun slipping out of his hand. "Those pretty legs are more dangerous than I suspected," spoke a familiar voice. Summer looked toward the bushes to see Trevor Miller emerge with a crooked smile. Like Summer, he was clad in a dry suit and appeared slightly out of breath. "Trevor," she stammered, shocked at seeing him there. "What are you doing here?"
"Same reason as you. Come on, let's get out of here."
He picked up the guard's gun and flung it into the bushes, then grabbed her hand and began running toward the dock. Summer saw a light turn on in the building as she raced to keep up with Trevor.
They didn't stop until they reached the dock, rushing over to where the security boat was moored. Summer stopped and gazed down at the water as Trevor scooped up the nearby dive gear and tossed it in the boat.
"Dirk went in the water," Summer panted, pointing toward the gangplank.
"I know," Trevor replied. He nodded toward the boat, then stepped aside. Sprawled across the stern bench, dazed and groggy, Dirk stared up at them through glassy eyes. With a laborious effort, he raised his head slightly and winked at his sister. Summer leaped into the boat and collapsed next to him in surprised relief.
"How did you make it out?" she asked,
eyeing a trickle of dried blood along his temple. Dirk weakly raised an arm and pointed at Trevor, who untied the lines and jumped into the boat. "No time for platitudes, I'm afraid," Trevor said with a hurried smile. Starting the motor, he gunned the throttle and spun the small boat around the back side of the tanker and out the covered dock. Never looking back, he aimed the boat down the channel and pushed it to its top speed. Summer tried to check Dirk's wound under the starlight, finding a large knot on the top of his skull that was still damp with blood. His dive hood had saved him from a deeper gouge to the skin, and perhaps a worse fate as well. "Forgot to wear my hard hat," he mumbled, trying hard to focus his eyes on Summer.
"Your hard head is much too tough to break," she said,
laughing aloud in an emotional release. The boat plowed through the darkness, Trevor hugging the shoreline until suddenly easing off the throttle. The darkened boat Summer had spotted earlier loomed ahead, now recognizable as Trevor's Canadian Resources vessel. Trevor brought the outboard alongside and helped Dirk and Summer aboard, then let the security boat drift. He quickly pulled anchor and motored the research craft down the channel. When they were well out of sight of the facility, he crossed to the opposite side of the channel, then turned and crept back toward Kitimat at slow speed. Cruising past the Terra Green facility, they witnessed several flashlight beams crisscrossing the grounds, but noticed no obvious alarms. The boat slipped unseen into the Kitimat dock, and Trevor killed its motor and tied it off. On the stern deck, Dirk had begun to regain form, save for some dizziness and a pounding head. He shook Trevor's hand after the ecologist helped him ashore.
"Thanks for fishing me out. I would have had a long sleep underwater if not for you."
"Entirely good luck. I was swimming along the dock when I heard the small boat come in. I was actually hiding in the water beneath the gangplank when the guard came ashore. I didn't even realize it was you until I recognized Summer's voice right before you went over the side. You hit the water just a few feet from me. When you didn't move, I immediately jammed my regulator in your mouth. The hard part was keeping us both submerged until we were out of view."
"Shame on a federal employee for trespassing on private property," Summer said with a grin.
"It's all your fault," Trevor replied. "You kept talking about the importance of the water samples, so I thought we needed to know if there was a link to the facility." He handed Summer a dive bag containing several small vials of water.
"Hope they match mine," Summer replied, showing her own samples.
"Of course, I'll need to get our boat back to complete the analysis." "Miller's taxi service is always open. I have a mining site inspection in the morning, but can run you back down in the afternoon."
"That would be fine. Thanks, Trevor.
Perhaps next time we should work a little closer together," Summer said with a beguiling smile. Trevor's eyes twinkled at her words. "I wouldn't want it any other way."
Chapter 22 Scattered chunks of ice dotted the rolling waters of Lancaster Strait, appearing in the dusk like jagged marshmallows floating in a sea of hot chocolate. Against the dim background of Devon Island, a black behemoth crept along the horizon, billowing a trail of dark smoke.
"Range 12 kilometers, sir. She's beating a path right across our bow."
The helmsman, a red-haired ensign with jug ears, peered from a radar scope to the ship's captain and waited for a response. Captain Dick Weber lowered a pair of binoculars without taking his gaze off the distant vessel.
"Keep us on intersect, at least until we obtain an identification," he replied without turning.
The helmsman twisted the ship's wheel a half-turn, then resumed studying the radar screen. The 80-foot Canadian Coast Guard patrol vessel plowed slowly through the dark Arctic waters toward the path of the oncoming vessel. Assigned to interdiction duty along the eastern approaches to the Northwest Passage, the Harp had been on station just a few days. Though the winter ice had continued the trend of breaking up early, this was the first commercial vessel the patrol craft had seen in the frosty waters this season. In another month or two, there would be a steady stream of massive tankers and container ships making the northerly transit, accompanied by icebreakers. Just a few years prior, the thought of policing traffic through the Northwest Passage would have been laughable. Since man's earliest forays into the Arctic, major sections of the annual winter pack ice remained frozen solid for all but a few summer days. Only a few hardy explorers and the occasional icebreaker dared fight their way through the blocked passage. But global warming had changed everything, and now the passage was navigable for months out of the year. Scientists estimate that over 40,000 square miles of Arctic ice have receded in just the past 30 years. Much of the blame for the rapid melt-off is due to the ice albedo feedback effect. In its frozen state, Arctic ice will reflect up to 90% of incoming solar radiation. When melted, the resulting seawater will conversely absorb an equal amount of radiation, reflecting only about 10%. This warming loop has accounted for the fact that Arctic temperatures are climbing at double the global rate. Watching the bow of his patrol boat slice through a small ice floe, Weber silently cursed what global climate change had done to him. Transferred from Quebec and comfortable sea duty along the St. Lawrence River, he now found himself in command of a ship at one of the most remote locations on the planet. And his job, he thought, had been relegated to little more than that of a toll booth operator. Weber could hardly blame his superiors, though, for they were just following the mandate of Canada's saber-rattling Prime Minister. When historically frozen sections of the Northwest Passage began to melt clear, the Prime Minister was quick to act, affirming the passage as Canadian internal waters and authorizing funds for a deep-water Arctic port at Nanisivik. Promises to build a fleet of military icebreakers and establish new Arctic bases soon followed. Powerful lobbying by a shadowy interest group propelled the Parliament to support the Prime Minister by passing tough restrictions on foreign vessels transiting the passage. By law, all non-Canadian flagged ships seeking transit through the passage were now required to notify the Coast Guard of their planned route, pay a passage fee similar to that imposed at the Panama Canal, and be accompanied by a Canadian commercial icebreaker through the more restrictive areas of the passage. A few countries, Russia, Denmark, and the United States among them, refuted Canada's claim and discouraged travel through the waters. But other developed nations gladly complied in the name of economics. Merchant ships serving Europe with East Asia could trim thousands of miles off their shipping routes by bypassing the Panama Canal. The savings were even more dramatic for ships too large to pass through the canal that would otherwise have to sail around Cape Horn. With the potential to cut the shipping cost of a single storage container by $1,000, merchant fleets, large and small, were quick to eye the Arctic crossing as a lucrative commercial path. As the ice melt-off expanded more rapidly than scientists anticipated, the first few shipping companies had begun testing the frigid waters. Thick sheets of ice still clogged sections of the route for much of the year, but during the heat of summer the passage had regularly become ice-free. With the aid of powerful icebreakers, the more ambitious merchant fleets were hoping to run the passage from April through September. It was becoming all too evident that within a decade or two, the Northwest Passage would be a navigable waterway year-round. Staring at the approaching black merchant ship, Weber wished the whole passage would just freeze solid again. At least the presence of the ship broke up the monotony of staring at icebergs, he thought dryly. 4 kilometers in closing, the helmsman reported. Weber turned to a lanky radio man wedged into a corner of the small bridge. Hopkins, request an identification in the nature of her cargo, he barked. The radio man proceeded to call the ship, but all his queries were met with silence. He checked the radio, then transmitted several more times. She's not responding, sir, he finally replied with a perplexed look. His experience with passing vessels in the Arctic was that they were usually prone to excessive chit-chat by the isolated crews. Keep trying, Weber ordered. We're nearly close enough for a visual ID. 2 kilometers off, the helmsman confirmed. Weber retrained his binoculars and examined the vessel. She was a relatively small container ship of no more than 400 feet. She was, by appearance, a newer vessel, but oddly showed only a few containers on her topside deck. Similar ships, he knew, often carried containers stacked 6 or 7 layers high. Curious, he studied her plimsoll line, noting the mark was several feet above the water. Moving his gaze vertically, he looked at a darkened bridge, then at a masthead behind the superstructure. He was startled to see the stars and stripes fluttering in the stiff breeze. "She's American," he muttered. The nationality surprised him, as American ships had informally boycotted the passage at the urging of their government. Weber focused the glasses on the ship's bow, just making out the name Atlanta in white lettering as the evening light began to fade. "Her name is the Atlanta," he said to Hopkins. The radio operator nodded and tried hailing the ship by name, but there was still no response. Weber hung the binoculars on a metal hook, then located a binder on the chart table and flipped it open, searching for the name Atlanta on a computer printout. All non-Canadian vessels making a transit of the Northwest Passage were required to file notification with the Coast Guard 96 hours in advance. Weber checked to see that his file had been updated by satellite link earlier in the day, but still found no reference for the Atlanta. "Bring us up on her port bow. Hopkins, tell them that they are crossing Canadian territorial waters and order her to stop for boarding and inspection." While Hopkins transmitted the message, the helmsman adjusted the ship's heading, then glanced at the radar screen. "The channel narrows ahead, sir," he reported. "Pack ice encroaching on our port beam approximately 3 kilometers ahead." Weber nodded, his eyes still glued to the Atlanta. The merchant ship was moving at a surprisingly fast clip, over 15 knots, he guessed. As the Coast Guard vessel edged closer, Weber again observed that the ship was riding high on the water. Why would a lightly laden ship be attempting the passage, he wondered. 1 kilometer to intercept, the helmsman said. Come right. Bring us to within 100 meters, the captain ordered. The black merchant ship was oblivious to the Coast Guard patrol craft, or so it seemed to the Canadians. Had they tracked the radar set more closely, they would have noticed that the American ship was both accelerating and subtly changing course. "Why won't they respond?" muttered the helmsman, growing weary of Hopkins's unanswered radio calls. "We'll get their attention now," Weber said. The captain walked to the console and pressed a button that activated the ship's marine air horn. 2 long blasts bellowed from the horn, the deep bray echoing across the water. The blare drew the men on the bridge to silence as they awaited a response. Again, there was none. There was little more Weber could do. Unlike in the United States, the Canadian Coast Guard was operated as a civilian organization. The Harp's crew was not military trained, and the vessel carried no armament. The helmsman eyed the radar screen and reported no reduction in speed. "In fact, I think she's still accelerating." "Sir, we're coming along the ice pack." Weber detected a sudden urgency in his voice. While focused on the merchant ship, the helmsman had neglected to track the hardened pack ice that now flanked their port side. To starboard, the steaming merchant ship rode just 12 meters away and had drawn nearly even with the patrol craft. Weber looked up at the high bridge of the Atlanta and wondered what kind of fool was in command of the ship. Then he noticed the bow of the freighter suddenly veer toward his own vessel, and he quickly realized this was no game. "Hard left rudder!" he screamed. The last thing anyone expected was for the merchant ship to turn into them, but in an instant the larger vessel was right on top of the Harp. Like a bug under the raised foot of an elephant, the patrol boat madly scrambled to escape a crushing blow. Frantically reacting to Weber's command, the helmsman jammed the wheel full over and prayed they would slip by the bigger ship. But the Atlanta was too close. The side hull of the freighter slammed into the Harp with a deep thud. The point of impact came to the boat's stern, however, as the smaller vessel had nearly turned away. The blow knocked the Harp hard over, nearly capsizing her as a large wave rolled over the deck. In what felt like an eternity to the stricken crew, the Coast Guard craft gradually rolled back upright as it fell away from the bristling sides of the merchant ship. Their peril was not over, however. Unknown to the crew, the collision had torn off the vessel's rudder. With its propeller still spinning madly, the patrol boat surged straight into the nearby ice pack. The Harp drove several feet into the thick ice before grounding to a sudden halt, flinging the ship's crew forward. On the bridge, Weber picked himself up off the deck and helped shut down the vessel's engine, then quickly assessed the health of his ship and crew. An assortment of cuts and bruises was the worst of the personal injuries, but the patrol boat fared less well. In addition to the lost rudder, the ship's crumpled bow had compromised the outer hull. The Harp would remain embedded in the ice for 4 days before a tow would arrive to take the ship to port for repairs. Wiping away a trickle of blood from a gash to his cheek, Weber stepped to the bridge wing and peered to the west. He saw the running lights of the merchant ship for just a second before the big ship disappeared into a gloomy, dark fog bank that stretched across the horizon. Watching as the ship disappeared, Weber shook his head. "You brazen bastard," he muttered. "You'll pay for this." Weber's words would prove to ring hollow. A fast-moving storm front south of Baffin Island grounded the Canadian Air Command's CP-140 Aurora reconnaissance plane, called in by the Coast Guard. When the aircraft finally lifted off from its base in Greenwood, Nova Scotia, and arrived over Lancaster Strait, more than 6 hours had elapsed. Farther west, a Navy icebreaker and another Coast Guard cutter blocked the passage off Prince of Wales Island, waiting for the belligerent freighter to arrive. But the large black ship never appeared. The Canadian Coast Guard and Air Force scoured the navigable seas around Lancaster Strait for 3 days in search of the rogue vessel. Every available route west was scrutinized several times over, yet the American merchant ship was nowhere to be seen. Baffled, the Canadian forces quietly called off the search, leaving Weber and his crew to wonder how the strange ship had somehow disappeared into the Arctic ice. Chapter 23 Dr. Kevin Bew peered at the blackening sky to the west and grimaced. Only hours earlier, the sun had shone brightly and the air was still while the mercury in the thermometer tickled 20 degrees Fahrenheit. But then the barometer had dropped like a stone in a well, accompanied by a gradual building of the westerly winds. A quarter of a mile away, the gray waters of the Arctic now rolled in deep swells that burst against the ragged edge of the ice pack with billowing fountains of spray. Tugging the hood of his parka tighter, he turned away from the stinging winds and surveyed his home of the last few weeks. Ice Research Lab 7 wouldn't rate many stars in the mobile travel guide for luxury or comfort. A half-dozen prefabricated buildings made up the camp, huddled in a semicircle with their entrances facing south. Three tiny bunkhouses were jammed together on one side next to the largest building, a combination galley, mess hall, and meeting area. A squat structure just opposite housed a joint lab and radio room, while a snow-covered storage shed rounded out the camp at the far end. The research lab was one of several Canadian Fisheries and Oceans Department temporary ice camps established as floating research labs to track and study the movements of the Arctic ice pack. Since the time Ice Research Lab 7 had been set up a year earlier, the camp had moved nearly 200 miles, riding a mammoth sheet of polar ice south across the Beaufort Sea. Now positioned 150 miles from the North American coastline, the camp sat on the edge of the ice shelf, almost due north of the Yukon Territory. The camp faced a short life, however. The approaching summer meant the breakup of the pack ice where the camp now found itself. Daily measurements of the ice beneath their feet revealed a steady melting already, which had reduced the pack thickness from 3 feet to 14 inches. Bew figured they had maybe 2 more weeks before he and his 4-man team would be forced to disassemble the camp and wait for evacuation by Twin Otter ski plane. The Arctic oceanographer trudged through ankle-deep snow toward the radio shack. Over the blowing rustle of ice particles bounding across the ground, he heard the whine of a diesel engine revving up and down.
Looking past the camp's structures, he spotted a yellow front-end track loader racing back and forth, its blunt blade piling up high mounds of drifted snow. The plow was keeping clear a 500-foot ice runway that stretched along the back of the camp. The crude landing strip was the camp's lifeline, allowing twin otters to bring in food and supplies on a weekly basis. Bew made sure that the makeshift runway was kept clear at all times. Ignoring the roving track loader, Bew entered the joint lab and radio hut, shaking the snow off his feet in an inner doorway before entering the main structure. Making his way past several cramped bays full of scientific journals and equipment, he turned into a closet-sized cubby that housed the satellite radio station. A wild-eyed man with sandy hair and a mirthful grin looked up from the radio set. Scott Case was a brilliant physicist who specialized in studying solar radiation at the poles. Like everyone else in the camp, Case wore multiple hats, including that of chief communications operator.
"Atmospherics are playing havoc with our radio signals again," he said to Bew. "Satellite reception is nil and our ground transmitter is little better."
"I'm sure the approaching storm isn't helping matters any," Bew replied.
"Does Tuktoyatuk even know that we're trying to hail them?"
Case shook his head.
"Can't tell for sure, but I've detected no callbacks."
The sound of the track loader shoving a load of ice just outside the structure echoed off the thin walls.
"You keeping the field clean just in case?"
he asked Bew.
"Tuktoyatuk has us scheduled for a supply drop later today. They may not know that we'll be in the middle of a gale-force blizzard in about an hour."
"Keep trying, Scott. See if you can wave off the flight for today, for the safety of the pilots."
Before Case could transmit again, the radio suddenly cackled.
An authoritative voice backed by static interference blared through the speaker.
"Ice Research Lab 7. Ice Research Lab 7, this is Numa Research Vessel Narwhal. Do you read? Over."
Bew beat Case to the transmitter and replied quickly.
"Narwhal, this is Dr. Kevin Bew of Ice Research Lab 7. Go ahead, please."
"Dr. Bew, we're not trying to eavesdrop, but we've heard your repeated calls to the Coast Guard station at Tuktoyatuk, and we've picked up a few unanswered calls back from Tuktoyatuk. It sounds like the weather is keeping you two from connecting. Can we assist in relaying a message for you?"
"We'd be most grateful."
Bew had the American ship forward a message to Tuktoyatuk to delay sending the supply plane for 24 hours on account of the poor weather. A few minutes later, the Narwhal radioed a confirmation back from Tuktoyatuk.
"Our sincere thanks," Bew radioed. "That will save some poor flyboy a rough trip."
"Don't mention it. Where is your camp located, by the way?"
Bew transmitted the latest position of the floating camp, and the vessel responded in kind.
"Are you boys in good shape to ride out the approaching storm?"
"Looks to be a mean one," the Narwhal radioed.
"We've managed everything the Good Witch of the North has thrown at us so far, but thanks all the same," Bew replied.
"Farewell, Ice Lab 7. Narwhal out."
Bew set down the transmitter with a look of relief.
"Who says the Americans don't belong in the Arctic after all?" he said to Case, then slipped on his parka and left the building.
35 miles to the southwest, Captain Bill Stenseth examined a local meteorological forecast with studious concern. An imposing man with Scandinavian features and the build of an NFL linebacker, Stenseth had weathered storms in every ocean of the world. Yet facing a sudden blow in the ice-studded Arctic still made the veteran captain of the Narwhal nervous.
"The wind seems to be ratcheting up a bit in the latest forecast," he said, without looking up from the document. "I think we're in for a pretty good gale." "Wouldn't want to be those poor saps hunkered down on the ice," he added, pointing toward the radio.
Standing beside Stenseth on the ship's bridge, Rudy Gunn suppressed a pained grin. Sailing through the teeth of a powerful Arctic storm was going to be anything but a pleasantry. He would gladly trade places with the ice camp members, who would likely sit out the storm in a warm hut playing pinochle, Gunn thought. Stenseth's preference for battling the elements at sea was clearly the mark of a lifelong sailor, one who never felt comfortable with his feet on the shore. Gunn shared no similar propensity. Though he was an Annapolis graduate who had spent several years at sea, he now spent more time sailing a desk. The deputy director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency, Gunn was usually found in the headquarters building in Washington, D.C. With a short, wiry build and horn-rimmed glasses on his nose, he was the physical opposite of Stenseth. Yet he shared the same adventurous pursuit of oceanographic challenges and was often on hand when a new vessel or piece of underwater technology was sea-tested for the first time.
"I'd have more pity for the polar bears," Gunn said. "How long before the storm front arrives?"
Stenseth eyed a growing number of white caps cresting off the ship's bow.
"About an hour. No more than two. I would suggest retrieving and securing the Bloodhound within the next 30 minutes.
They won't like returning to the kennel so soon. I'll head down to the operations room and pass the word. Captain, please let me know if the weather deteriorates any sooner than predicted."
Stenseth nodded as Gunn left the bridge and made his way aft. The 200-foot research ship was rolling steadily through a building sea, and Gunn had to grasp a handrail several times to steady himself. Nearing the stern, he looked down at a large moon pool cut through the vessel's hull. Surface water was already sloshing back and forth, spilling onto the surrounding deck. Stepping down a companionway, he entered a door marked Lab, which opened up into a large bay. At the far end was a sectioned area with numerous video monitors mounted on the bulkhead. Two technicians sat tracking and recording a data feed from underwater.
"Are they on the bottom?" Gunn asked one of the technicians.
"Yes," the man replied. "They're about 2 miles east of us. Actually crossed the border into Canadian waters, as a matter of fact."
"Do you have a live transmission?"
The man nodded and passed his communication headset to Gunn.
"Bloodhound, this is Narwhal. We're seeing a rapid deterioration in the weather conditions up here. Request you break off survey and return to the surface."
A long pause followed Gunn's transmission, and then a static-filled reply was heard.
"Roger, Narwhal," came a gruff voice with a Texas accent. "Breaking off survey in 30 minutes. Bloodhound, over and out."
Gunn started to reply, then thought better of it. It was pointless to argue with the pair of hardheads at the other end, he thought. Yanking off the headset, he silently shook his head, then sank into a high-backed chair and waited for the half-hour to pass.
Chapter 24.
Like the canine it was named for, the Bloodhound scoured the earth with its nose to the ground. Only the ground was 2,000 feet beneath the surface of the Beaufort Sea, and its nose was a rigid electronic sensor pod. A titanium-hulled two-man submersible, the Bloodhound was purpose-built to investigate deep-water hydrothermal vents. The submerged geysers, which spewed superheated water from the Earth's crust, often spawned a treasure trove of unusual plant and sea life. Of greater interest to the men in the Numa submersible were the potential mineral deposits associated with many hydrothermal vents. Discharged from deep under the seabed, the vents often spewed a mineral-rich concoction of small nodules containing manganese, iron, and even gold. Advances in underwater mining technology made the thermal vent fields potentially significant resources.
"Water temperature is up another degree. That old smokestack has got to be down here somewhere," drawled the deep voice of Jack Dahlgren.
Sitting in the submersible's co-pilot seat, the muscular marine engineer studied a computer monitor through steely blue eyes. Scratching his thick cowboy mustache, he gazed out the plexiglass viewport at a drab, featureless bottom starkly illuminated by a half-dozen high-intensity lights. There was nothing in the subsea physical landscape to indicate that a hydrothermal vent was anywhere nearby.
"We might just be chasing a few hiccups from down under," replied the pilot. Turning a sharp eye toward Dahlgren, he added, "A bum steer, you might say."
Al Giordino grinned at the jest, nearly losing an unlit cigar that dangled from his mouth. A short, burly Italian with arms the size of tree trunks, Giordino was most at home riding a pilot seat. After spending years in Numa's special projects group, where he had piloted everything from blimps to bathyscaphs, he now headed the agency's underwater technology division. For Giordino, building and testing prototype vessels such as the Bloodhound was more of a passion than a job. He and Dahlgren had already spent 2 weeks scouring the Arctic seabed in search of thermal vents. Utilizing prior bathymetric surveys, they targeted areas of subsurface rifts and uplifts that were outgrowths of volcanic activity and potential home ground for active thermal vents. The search had been fruitless so far, discouraging the engineers who were anxious to test the submersible's capabilities. Dahlgren ignored Giordino's remark and looked at his watch.
It's been 20 minutes since Rudy gave us the call back. He's probably a sack of nerves by now. We probably ought to think about punching the up button, or else there will be 2 storms facing us topside.
Rudy's not happy unless he has something to fret about, Giordino replied. But I guess there's no upside in tempting the weather gods.
He turned the pilot's yoke left, angling the submersible to the west while keeping it hovering just above the seafloor. They had traveled several hundred yards when the bottom became flecked with a succession of small boulders. The rocks grew larger as Giordino noted that the seafloor was gradually rising. Dahlgren picked up a bathymetric chart and tried to pinpoint their position.
There looks to be a small seamount in the neighborhood. Didn't look too promising to the seismic boys for some reason.
Probably because they've been sitting inside a climate-controlled office for too many years.
Dahlgren set aside the chart and gazed at the computer monitor, suddenly jumping up in his seat.
Hot damn! The water temperature just spiked 10 degrees.
A slight grin spread across Giordino's face as he noted the cluster of rocks on the seabed growing in size and mass.
The seafloor geology is changing as well, he said. The profile looks good for a vent. Let's see if we can trace the water temperature to its core.
He adjusted the submersible's path as Dahlgren read out the water temperature readings. The higher temperatures led them up a sharp rise in the seafloor. A high mound of boulders blocked their path, and Giordino drove the submersible upward like an airplane, ascending nose first until they cleared the summit. As they descended down the opposite side, the scene before them suddenly changed dramatically. The gray, drab moonscape transformed into an iridescent underwater oasis. Yellow mollusks, red tube worms, and bright gold spider crabs littered the seafloor in a rainbow of color. A blue squid squirted past the viewport, followed by a school of silver-scaled polar cod. Almost instantaneously, they had traveled from a desolate world of black and white to an electric-colored plantation teeming with life.
"Now I know how Dorothy felt when she landed in Oz," Dahlgren muttered.
"What's the water temperature now?"
"We've jetted to 72 degrees Fahrenheit and rising. Congratulations, boss. You've just bought yourself a thermal vent."
Giordino nodded with satisfaction.
"Mark our position. Then let's exercise the mineral sniffer before..."
The radio suddenly crackled with a transmission sent via a pair of underwater transponders.
"Narwhal to Bloodhound. Narwhal to Bloodhound," interrupted a tense voice over the radio. "Please ascend immediately. Seas are running at 10 feet and building rapidly. I repeat, you are directed to ascend immediately."
"Before Rudy calls us home," Dahlgren said, finishing Giordino's sentence.
Giordino grinned.
"Ever notice how Rudy's voice goes up a couple of octaves when he's nervous?"
"Last time I looked, he was still signing my paycheck," Dahlgren cautioned.
"I suppose we don't want to scratch the paint on our new baby here. Let's grab a few quick rock samples first, then we can head topside."
Dahlgren radioed a reply to Gunn, then reached over and grabbed the controls to an articulated arm that rested upright on the submersible's exterior hull. Giordino guided the Bloodhound to a patch of grapefruit-sized nodules, hovering the sensor pod over the rocks. Using the stainless steel arm as a broom, Dahlgren swept several of the rocks into a basket beneath the sensor head. Onboard computers quickly assayed the density and magnetic properties of the rock samples.
"Composition is igneous. Appears consistent with pyroxene. I'm seeing concentrations of manganese and iron. Also reading elements of nickel, platinum, and copper sulfides," Dahlgren reported, eyeing a computer readout.
"That's a pretty high-octane start.
Save the assessment. We'll have the lab boys crack open the samples and see how accurate the sensor readings are. Once the storm passes, we can give the site a thorough inspection. She looks like a sweet one. I'm still a bit disappointed, my West Texas friend, Giordino replied with a shake of his head. No gold? No gold. I guess the closest I can get is just riding to the surface with a gold bricker. To Dahlgren's chagrin, Giordino's laughter echoed off the interior walls of the submersible for the better part of their ascent.
Chapter 25.
The Beaufort Sea was boiling with 12-foot waves and near gale-force winds when the Bloodhound burst through the surface of the Narwhal's moon pool. Water inside the pool sloshed onto the deck as the research ship pitched and rolled in the mounting seas. Twice the steel flanks of the submersible slapped against the cushioned rim of the moon pool before hoisting lines could be attached and the vessel yanked out of the water. Giordino and Dahlgren quickly climbed out of the Bloodhound and collected their rock samples before fleeing the elements into the adjacent operations center. Gunn stood waiting for them with a look of displeasure on his face. "That's a $10 million submersible that you nearly crushed like a beer can," he said, glaring at Giordino. "You know we're not allowed to launch and recover in these kind of weather conditions." As if to emphasize his point, the ship's drive shaft suddenly shuddered beneath their feet as the vessel wallowed heavily through a deep trough. "Relax, Rudy." Giordino beamed, then tossed one of the dripping rocks over to Gunn. Numa's deputy director fumbled to catch it, smearing his shirt with mud and seawater in the process. "You're on the trail?" he asked, his brows arching as he examined the rock. "Better than that," Dahlgren piped in. "We sniffed out some thermal deviations, and Al drove us right to the heart of the vent. A sweet mile-long rift pouring out hot soup with plenty of dumplings." Gunn's face softened. "You'd better have found something for surfacing so late." His gaze turned to that of a kid in a candy store. "Did you see indications of a mineral field?" "A large one, by the looks of it," Giordino replied, nodding. "We only saw a section of it, but it appears widely dispersed." "And the electronic sensors? How did the Bloodhound perform?" "She was barking like a coyote under a full moon," Dahlgren replied. "The sensors diagnosed over 13 different elements." "We'll have to leave it for the lab analysis to determine the Bloodhound's accuracy," Giordino added. "According to the sensors, that soggy rock you're holding is chock full of manganese and iron. There's probably enough of that stuff littering the bottom to buy you 1,000 bloodhounds, Rudy," Dahlgren said. "Did the sensors indicate any gold content?" Gunn asked. Giordino's eyes rolled skyward, then he turned to leave the ops center. "Everybody thinks I'm Midas," he grumbled before disappearing out the door.
Chapter 26.
The spring storm was not widespread, but packed the concentrated punch of a heavyweight boxer as it rolled southeast across the Beaufort Sea. Pummeling wind gusts of over 60 miles per hour blew the falling snow in horizontal sheets, turning the flakes to hardened particles of ice. Gusting swirls spread thick curtains over the white ice, often plunging visibility down to zero. The already hostile environment of the Arctic North became a place of brutal savagery. Kevin Bew listened to the frames of the mess hall creak and shudder under the bristling gale and idly contemplated the structure's strength rating. Draining the remains of a cup of coffee, he tried to concentrate on a scientific journal spread open on the table. Though he had experienced a dozen storms during his tenure in the Arctic, he still found their ferocity unnerving. While the rest of the crew went about their jobs, Bew found it hard to focus when the entire camp sounded like it was about to blow away. A heavyset cook and part-time carpenter named Benson sat down at the table across from Bew and sipped at his own steaming mug of coffee.
"Pretty good blow, huh?" he said, grinning through a thick black beard.
"Sounds like it's about to take us along with it," Bew replied, eyeing the roof overhead swaying back and forth.
"Well, if it does, I sure hope it deposits us somewhere where the weather is warm and the drinks taste better cold," he replied, sipping at his coffee.
Eyeing Bew's empty cup, he reached over and grabbed the handle, then stood up.
Here, let me get you a refill.
Benson walked across the mess to a large silver urn and refilled the cup. He started back toward Bew, then suddenly froze with a quizzical look on his face. Above the din of the buffeting wind, he detected a low-pitched mechanical churn. That wasn't what bothered him, though. It was the sharp crackling sound accompanying it that struck a nerve deep in his gut. Bew glanced up at Benson, then picked up on the sound as well. The noise was drawing upon them rapidly, and Bew thought he heard a shout somewhere off in the compound before his whole world collapsed around him. With a crunching jar, the back wall of the mess hall completely disintegrated, replaced by a massive gray wedge. The towering object quickly surged through the room, laying waste to a 30-foot swath of destruction. Torn free from its supports, the hut's roof flew off in a gust, while a blast of cold air flooded the interior. Bew looked on in horror as the gray mass devoured Benson in a spray of ice and froth. For one moment, the chef was standing there holding a mug of coffee. In the next instant, he was gone. The floor buckled up beneath Bew, throwing him and the table toward the entry door. Struggling to his feet, he stood and stared at the gray behemoth that materialized before him. It was a ship, his jumbled mind finally fathomed, storming through the center of the camp and the thin ice beneath it. The swirling snowy winds gave the vessel a ghostly appearance, but he was able to make out the large numbers 54 painted in white on the bow. As the bow burst past with a deep rumble, Bew caught glimpse of a large American flag rippling from the ship's masthead before the vessel disappeared into a cloud of white. He instinctively staggered back toward it, calling out for Benson until nearly stepping into a black river of water that now trailed the ship. Dazedly shaking off his state of shock, Bew pulled on his parka that lay crumpled on the ground and stepped past the remains of the entryway. Fighting his way against the winds, he tried to assess the condition of the camp while noting that the ground beneath his feet seemed to sway in an odd manner. Circling a few dozen feet to his right, he stopped at a ledge where the ice dropped away to open water. Just beyond him was where all three bunkhouses had stood. Now, they were all gone, replaced by scattered chunks of ice floating in the dark water. Bew's heart sank, knowing that one of his men had been off duty and asleep in his bunk just a short time before. That still left two men unaccounted for, Case the radio operator and Quinlan the maintenance man. Bew turned his attention toward the lab building, catching sight of the structure's blue walls still standing in the distance. Struggling to move closer, he nearly fell into the water again, finding a lead in the ice that separated him from the lab. Against his better judgment, he took a running leap and hopped over the 3-foot chasm, falling hard to the ice on the opposite side. Willing himself forward, he staggered into the wind until reaching the threshold. Resting briefly, he burst through the door, then froze. The interior of the lab, like the mess hall, had been obliterated by the passing ship. Little remained standing beyond the doorway, just some scattered remains floating in the water a few feet away. Miraculously, the radio shack had somehow survived the blow, severed from the main building but still standing upright. Through the whistling wind, Bew could hear Case's voice calling out a plea for help. Stepping closer, Bew found Case seated at his desk, talking into a dead radio set. The ice camp's power generators, stowed in the storage building, had been one of the first things to sink when the ship charged through. There was no power left in the camp, nor had there been any for several minutes. Bew put his hand on Case's shoulder, and the radio man slowly set down the transmitter, his eyes glazed with fear. Suddenly a crackling sound erupted beneath them, and the ground began to shudder. "It's the ice!" Bew shouted. "Get out of here now!" He pulled Case to his feet, and the two men scrambled out of the shack and across the ice as the crackling sound seemed to chase them. They hopped over a low rise and turned to see the ice beneath the lab and radio hut shatter like a cracked mirror. The surface splintered into a dozen chunks of loose ice that quickly fell apart, causing the remains of the structure to dissolve into the water below. In less than 2 minutes, the entire camp had disappeared before Bew's eyes. As the two men stared blankly at the destruction, Bew thought he heard the shout of a man above the wind. Peering through the blowing maelstrom, he strained his ears to hear it again. but his eyes caught sight first of a figure flailing in the water near the site of the radio shack. "It's Quinlan!" Case yelled, also spotting the man. Regaining his composure, Case bolted toward the struggling maintenance man. Quinlan was rapidly losing a fight against shock from immersion into the icy water. Laden by his parka and boots, he would have quickly sunk had he not been able to grab hold of a floating chunk of ice. He quickly lost the energy to pull himself out of the water, but propelled himself toward Bew and Case with his last ounce of effort. The two men ran to the edge of the ice and reached out for Quinlan, desperately grasping a flailing arm. Pulling him closer, they tried to yank him from the water, but could only get him a few inches out of the water before he fell back in. With his saturated boots and clothing, the average-built Quinlan now weighed over 300 pounds. Realizing their error, Bew and Case lunged at the human load again, dragging and rolling him horizontally until finally coercing his entire body out of the water. "We've got to get him out of the wind," Bew said, looking around for shelter. All of the man-made remnants of the camp were gone, save for a small section of the crumpled storage shed, now floating away on a car-sized chunk of ice. "The snowbank by the runway," Case replied, pointing through the swirling snow. Quinlan's efforts to keep the airfield clear had resulted in several deep snowbanks built up from his plowing. Though most of the airfield had now vanished, Case was right. There was a high mound of snow less than 50 yards away. Each man grabbed one of Quinlan's arms and began dragging him across the ice like a bag of potatoes. They knew the maintenance man was near death, and if he was to have any chance of survival, they would have to move him clear of the -20 degrees wind chill. Panting and perspiring despite the bitter cold, they hauled Quinlan to the backside of the 10-foot snowbank, which blocked the worst of the westerly gale. They quickly stripped off Quinlan's wet clothes, which had already frozen stiff, then they briefly rubbed snow on his body to absorb the remaining moisture. Brushing the snow aside, they then wrapped his head and body in their own dry parkas. Quinlan was blue and shaking uncontrollably, but he was still conscious, which meant he had a chance at survival. Following Case's lead, Bew helped dig a small hole into the side of the snowbank. Sliding Quinlan in first, the other two men crawled alongside, hoping to share body heat while cowering from the slashing winds. Peering out of their meager cave, Bew could see a watery passage expanding between their shelter and the unbroken ice sheet. They were part of a separate ice floe now, drifting slowly into the Beaufort Sea. Every few minutes, the scientist would hear a deep, thunderous crack as their floating ice shelf ruptured into smaller and smaller pieces. Propelled into the storm-driven waters, he knew it would only be a matter of time before their own frozen refuge would be battered to bits and all three men tossed into the sea. With no one else even aware of their predicament, they had no hope for survival. Shivering in the frightful cold, Bew contemplated the merciless gray ship that had decimated the camp so unexpectedly and without reason. Try as he might, his frozen mind could make no sense of the brutal act. Shaking his head to clear away the marauding vessel's ghost-like image, he peered at his comrades with sad compassion, then quietly awaited death to visit them all. Chapter 27 The radio call had arrived faintly and in a single transmission. Repeated efforts by the Narwhal's radio operator to verify the message was met with complete silence. Captain Stenzeth read the hand-scribbled message transcribed by his radio man, shook his head, and then read the message once more.
"Mayday, mayday. This is Ice Lab 7. The camp is breaking up," he recited aloud. "That's all you got?" he asked, his eyes glaring. The radio man nodded silently. Stenzeth turned and stepped to the helmsman. "All ahead flank speed," he barked. "Come left. Steer course 015. He turned to the executive officer. "I want a plot to the Ice Lab's reported position, and call 3 additional lookouts to the bridge." In an instant, he was towering over the radio operator's shoulder. "Notify the regional U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards of the distress call and tell them that we are responding. Alert any local traffic if there is any. Then get Gunn and Giordino to the bridge."
"Sir, the nearest Coast Guard station is Canadian, at Tuktoyaktuk. That's over 200 miles away."
Stenzith gazed at the blowing wind buffeting the bridge's windscreens, his mind conjuring an image of the ice camp inhabitants. Softening his tone, he replied quietly, "Then I guess that means their only saving angel is wearing turquoise wings." The narwhal was rated at 23 knots, but even running flat out, the research ship could barely muster a dozen knots lunging through the storm-whipped seas. The storm had reached its peak, with winds gusting over 70 miles per hour. The sea was a boiling cauldron of 30-foot waves that pitched and rolled the ship like it was made of cork. The helmsman nervously monitored the ship's autopilot, waiting for the mechanism to go tilt from the constant course corrections necessary to keep the vessel on a fixed northeast heading. Gunn and Giordino soon joined Stenzith on the bridge, studying the ice camp's mayday message. "It is a little early in the season for the ice to be breaking up in a cataclysmic fashion," Gunn said, rubbing his chin. "Though the moving ice sheet can certainly fracture on short notice. Typically, you would have a little bit of a warning." Perhaps they were surprised by a small fracture that struck a portion of the camp, such as their radio facility or even their power generators, Stenzith suggested. "Let's hope it's nothing worse than that," Gunn agreed, gazing at the maelstrom outside. "As long as they have some degree of shelter from the storm, they should be all right for a while." "There is another possibility," Giordino added quietly. "The ice camp may have been situated too close to the sea. The storm surge could have broken up the leading edge of the ice field, taking the camp apart in the process." The other two men nodded grimly, knowing that the odds of survival were severely diminished if that was the case. "What's the outlook on the storm?" Gunn asked.
"Another 6 to 8 hours before it abates. We'll have to wait it out before we can drop a search team on the ice, I'm afraid," Stenzith replied.
"Sir," the helmsman interrupted, "we're seeing large ice in the water." Stenzith looked up to see a house-sized iceberg slip past the port bow. "All engines back a third. What's our distance to the ice camp?"
"Just under 18 miles, sir."
Stenzith stepped over to a large radar screen and adjusted the range to a 20-mile diameter. A thin, jagged green line crossed the screen near the top edge, which remained fixed in place. The captain pointed to a spot just below the line, where a concentric ring on the scope indicated a distance of 20 miles.
"Here's the reported position of the camp," he said somberly. "If it was an oceanfront property before, it is now," Giordino observed.
Gunn squinted at the radar scope, then pointed a finger at a fuzzy dot at the edge of the screen.
"There's a ship nearby," he said.
Stenzith took a look, noting that the ship was headed to the southeast. He ordered the radio operator to hail the ship, but they failed to receive a response.
"Maybe an illegal whaler," the captain suggested.
"The Japanese occasionally slip into the Beaufort to hunt beluga whales."
"In these seas, they're probably too busy hanging onto their shorts to pick up the radio," Giordino said.
The unknown vessel was quickly forgotten as they closed in on the ice shelf and the reported position of the ice camp. As the narwhal crept closer to the site, larger and larger slabs of broken ice began clogging up the sea in front of them. By now, the entire ship's complement had been alerted of the rescue mission. More than a dozen research scientists braved the harsh weather and joined the crew on deck. Dressed in full foul weather gear, they lined the rails of the ominously rolling ship, scanning the seas for their fellow Arctic scientists. The narwhal arrived at the ice camp's reported position, and Stenzith brought the narwhal to within 100 feet of the ice sheet. The research ship cruised slowly along the jagged border, dodging around numerous icebergs that had recently severed from the ice field. The captain ordered every light on board illuminated and repeatedly let loose a blast from the ship's deafening Kallenberg air horns as a possible rescue beacon. The powering winds began to abate slightly, allowing brief glimpses through the swirling snow. All eyes scanned the thick shelf of the sea ice, as well as the frozen waters, for signs of the ice camp or its inhabitants. Drifting over the camp's reported position, not a sign was detected. If anything or anybody was left at the scene, they were now residing 2,000 feet beneath the dark gray waters.
Chapter 28 Kevin Bew had watched their perch on the ice dissolve from a battleship-sized sheet of ice to that of a small house. The battering sea waves would rip and shove at the iceberg, splintering it into smaller fragments that would be subject to the same dissecting forces. While their refuge grew smaller, the ride grew rougher as they drifted farther into the Beaufort Sea. The shrinking berg wallowed and dipped in the churning seas, while surging waves repeatedly swept over the lower reaches. Shivering in the bitter cold, Bew found himself suffering the added discomfort of seasickness. Looking at the two men beside him, he could hardly complain. Quinlan was close to slipping into a hypothermia-induced unconsciousness, while Case seemed to be headed down the same path. The radio operator sat curled in a ball, his glazed eyes staring blankly ahead. Bew's efforts at conversation were met with nothing more than a blink of the eyes. Bew considered stripping the parkas off Quinlan so that he and Case might regain some warmth, but thought better of it. Although Quinlan was as good as dead, their own outlook for survival was no better. Bew stared at the turbulent gray water surrounding their frozen raft and contemplated diving into the sea. At least it would end things quickly. The idea passed when he decided it would take too much energy to walk the dozen paces to the water's edge. A large swell rocked the ice platform, and he heard a sharp thump beneath his feet. A crack suddenly materialized beneath his snow-carved seat, extending rapidly across the berg. With a jolt from the next oncoming wave, the entire section of ice beneath him abruptly fell away, dissolving into the dark sea. Bew instinctively grabbed onto the sharp face of the snowbank, lodging a foot on the small ledge that held Quinlan. Case, sitting on the opposite side, never moved a muscle as Bew desperately clung to a vertical cleft of the ice, dangling just a few feet above the stinging waves. Bew felt his heart pounding wildly, and with a desperate lunge, he jabbed his fingers into the ice and pulled himself up and on top of the remaining snow mound. Their haven had shrunk to the size of a minivan and now rocked violently in the rough seas. Bew teetered on the top, waiting for the whole mound to turn turtle and send the three men on an icy plunge to their deaths. It would be a matter of minutes now, he knew, before their ride would come to an end. Then, through the wind-swept snow, he saw a bright light, beaming like the sun behind a rain squall. It blinded his eyes, and he shut his lids tightly to escape the searing beam. When he opened them a few seconds later, the light had vanished. All he could see was the white of the dry ice that peppered his face in the fierce wind. He strained to detect the light again, but there was nothing to see but the storm. Slowly, he closed his eyes in defeat, sagging as the strength ebbed from his pores. Chapter 29 Jack Dahlgren already had a fueled Zodiac winched above the gunwale when the call came from the bridge to launch. Dressed in a bright yellow Mustang survival suit, he climbed aboard and checked that a portable GPS unit and a two-way radio were stowed in a watertight bin. He started the outboard engine, then waited as a squat figure came charging across the deck. Al Giardino didn't have time to put on an exposure suit, simply grabbed a parka on the bridge and hustled down to the Zodiac. As Giardino leaped in, Dahlgren gave a thumbs-up sign to a waiting crewman, who quickly lowered the inflatable boat into the sea. Dahlgren waited until Giardino released the drop hook, then gunned the motor. The small inflatable burst over and through a high rolling wave, sending plumes of icy spray skyward. Giardino ducked from the spray, then pointed an arm ahead of the narwhal. "We're after a small berg about 200 yards off the port bow," he yelled. "There's an ice sheet dead ahead, so you'll have to go hard around," he added, waving to the left. Through the blinding snow, Dahlgren could just make out a fuzzy mass of white on the surface directly ahead. Taking a quick compass bearing, he eased the Zodiac to port until the ice sheet loomed up a few yards in front of him. Turning sharply, he sped along the perimeter, slowing slightly when he figured that he had reached the opposite side. The narwhal was no longer in view behind them, while the ice sheet had given way to dozens of small icebergs rolling in the heavy seas. The pounding winds blew snow particles off the nearby ice sheet, reducing visibility to less than 50 feet. Giardino sat perched on the prow, scanning the seas like an eagle in search of prey, motioning Dahlgren to turn this way, then that. They motored through trunk-sized chunks of ice mixed with larger bergs,
all swaying and smashing into one another. Giordino had them circle several small bergs before frantically pointing at a tall, swaying spire of ice. "That's the one!" he yelled. Dahlgren hit the throttle, racing over to the floating wedge of ice that looked to him like all the others. Only this one had a patch of darkness on the crest. As the Zodiac drew near, Dahlgren saw that it was a human body sprawled across the top. He quickly circled the berg, looking for a place to land the boat, but the ice showed only steep vertical slopes on all sides. Reaching the opposite end, he noticed two other men wedged into a crude dugout cut a few feet above the water. "Ram it beneath that ledge," Giordino yelled. Dahlgren nodded, then replied, "Hang on." He circled the Zodiac around to garner momentum, then gunned the throttle while aiming straight for the berg. The inflatable boat's prow skidded over a slight lip of ice before plunging hard into the snowbank just beneath.